Hey, Corey here. We've had an influx of new listeners, and so I just want to make sure that if you are new to the podcast, you don't just jump in and start listening to these daily episodes, which we've been doing. Please go back and listen to the first at least 8 episodes so you have an idea of what Collapse is, what it is that Corey is talking about. Also, if you've been with us for a while and you're enjoying the content, please join us on Patreon. We would love to see you there. There's a link, as always, in the description. Okay, happy Friday, everybody. Normally, I share something like 16 to 20 different sources or articles on these Friday episodes. This week, I'm going to narrow it down a little bit. I have only 10 or so different articles to share. This means I'll dive into each one a little bit deeper than normal. Instead of just kind of mentioning the headline, we might dive into a couple of these articles. So the first big news this week from U.S. politics was, of course, that the Democrats caved on the government shutdown. It reached a historic milestone. It was the longest government shutdown we've ever had at 43 days. This article in particular is in Politico. It is titled, Schumer is no longer effective, Dems outraged over shutdown deal. And this caused quite a stir. You know, this happened at a time in which polling showed that people were more and more blaming Republicans rather than Democrats for the shutdown, despite Republicans' efforts to throw all the blame at Democrats, despite President Trump continually making inflammatory statements. It was becoming more and more apparent that this was on Republicans and the GOP for not putting forth any effort to negotiate on extending health care benefits. That said, enough Democrats, 8 of them, made the choice to flip and vote in favor of ending the shutdown without any sort of concession or help on extending ACA subsidy benefits. This means that millions of Americans will see their healthcare costs rise. If you are not in the U.S., then I'm sure you already know that the U.S. is known for very expensive healthcare. Those insurance premiums for many people are expected to double or in some cases as much as triple. Now, this is not going to be the case for everyone, but it is going to be the case in many instances for the most vulnerable, for those who have the least ability to make those payments. There are lots of ideas, speculations, theories on why the Democrats caved, none of them extremely convincing. Maybe the most convincing theories that I've heard is that those Democrats were nervous about pushing the Republicans to end the filibuster, which would be detrimental, of course, in the long term and the short term, frankly, and that by ending the shutdown, they may have lowered that pressure from Trump to do that. Other theories say that along with that, there was simply no chance that Republicans were ever going to offer concessions, that they were never going to negotiate, and that they were just watching their constituents be harmed by the shutdown. Which, look, I mean, yes, the shutdown itself is terrible. But there were options, there were requirements from judges to help those people, which the Trump administration, Trump himself, was ending, was purposefully disregarding. Nonetheless, it is over now and we move on. We can only hope that those who chose this on both the Republican and Democrat side will face the wrath of voters at the midterms. Now, normally when I do these Friday episodes, you know, I do my research, I open up my different tabs, choose which articles I want to talk about, and then I group them based on the category. So I'll have one for what's happening with ICE, and I'll have multiple articles there, and then I'll have another one that's based on geopolitical tensions, and then I'll have another one that's on corruption. Today I started grouping them, and I realized that a solid 80% of these are in the corruption category. And in fact, it's the only category that I had today. So at the end, I'll have a couple one-off articles. And the majority of this episode is based around the corruption that is currently happening within the Trump administration. So speaking in that category, but staying along the lines of the government shutdown, this new funding bill that reopened the U.S. government specifically will pay out 9 Congress members over $1 million each. Not only did Democrats cave, they also conceded a few special items that Republicans slipped into the bill at the last moment. One of those is that Republicans who were essentially targeted or had their phones tapped during the January 6th probe are essentially able to claim up to $500,000 per instance, and it says no less than $500,000 per instance, of wiretapping, not from the federal government, but from taxpayers. It names a few different Congress members, says they had three phones and three emails each, and each wiretapping recording is a separate instance. These Congress members in question could receive more than $3 million in damages. So just like Donald Trump, having been targeted, as he claims, by the Department of Justice, is suing, essentially, he's claiming up to $230 million for himself as a payout, these Congress members decided to get theirs as well. During the shutdown, the GOP basically changed the out-of-office responses from Republican Congress people so that when people called in or emailed in, the response blamed Democrats for the shutdown. This was not a voluntary response from these Congress people. It was forced upon them, and a judge ordered that this went against their First Amendment rights. Now, of course, the negative being here that the Trump administration again attempted to commit crimes in order to, or I should say, infringed constitutional rights in order to further their agenda. On the positive side, judges continue to stand up for the Constitution and the law in many cases. And while, that should be a given, we can still feel that these are small, albeit very small, wins from the judiciary. Another potential win from the shutdown ending is that Adelita Grijalva has now been sworn in to Congress and became the 218th member to sign their name on a petition that would require a vote in the House to release the Epstein files, all of the Epstein files that have been unclassified and that the DOJ has access to. Donald Trump has doubled down, threatening Republicans in Congress regarding the Epstein files, essentially saying that it's a distraction to not focus on it. He is doing everything to threaten members of his own party against voting to release the files. It is, frankly, very difficult to comprehend how brazen and obvious this is. The President of the United States and members of the Republican Party are pedophiles, and they are openly attempting to keep information hidden that could harm them. In the past, even the mere implication that a president or Congress member sexually assaulted anyone, adults, but let alone children, just the question or the doubt would be enough to remove them from office. In this case, we have a president of the United States whose followers are having to bend over backwards to deny, to reject these claims. They are so in your face. The evidence is there. His reaction to it is so telling. And yet he persists, and this has not been a career-ending development. Now, if the Epstein files were released and it was found that Donald Trump is all over them, if there was undeniable evidence of these claims, would that be enough? Well, I would sure hope so. But it's sad that even that is in doubt. Now, to further complicate things, the likelihood of this passing everything that it needs to pass in order for the Epstein files to be released is also unlikely. It is going to the House for a vote, which is a great start. And it very well may and likely will pass the House. After that, though, it goes to the Senate, where there's a little bit more concern about whether or not it will pass in the Senate. And from my understanding, that from there, it will go to the president's desk where he would have to sign it. And of course, that's not going to happen. He is going to veto it. At that point, in order to skip the veto, essentially, for Congress to make this happen without the authority of the president, it would have to have a two-thirds vote, which with Adelita Grijalva being, the 218th, that's a simple majority. So she was basically the 51st percentile, putting it just over a majority to even get it voted on in the House. So something would have to change drastically between now and then to get something like 60 or so more votes from the House. And then, of course, in the Senate, it would need two-thirds, so at least 67 to vote for it. So I think it faces a very big uphill battle. There is also the question about the fact that this is in the hands of the Department of Justice, Trump's Department of Justice. We've heard stories about the FBI having thousands of people sorting through it, looking for Donald Trump, his name in the Epstein files, and the potential for that information to be redacted, removed, and scrubbed, right? So while there's a small amount of hope, very small, that this will come to light and that justice will be served, it seems like an uphill battle. There's always the possibility here that, and the likelihood, probably, honestly, that it's not just the DOJ that has all of this information or some of this. that there are other parties that have damning evidence. And so if information were to be released that implicated some but not others, those who were implicated, if they have more information, they may be able to testify against Trump to lower their own sentences. Like there's still ways in which the information can come to light. You know, what does Ghislaine, however you say it, Maxwell know? What information does she have? What evidence does she have? What evidence do other state actors have? There's all these theories that Russia and Israel and others have lots of information on Donald Trump as well, which is why he is bowing to them in so many ways. On this note, there's a couple of articles. One is from CNN. It says, exclusive, Trump administration holds Situation Room meeting over House effort to force release of all DOJ's Epstein files. Essentially, he called together a meeting with the House of Representatives, with the GOP, to basically, we don't know exactly what he's going to say or how that meeting goes, but he is basically threatening them, begging them, doing whatever he has to do to get people to flip and not move forward with the vote. There are a few key players in this. Boebert is one of them, Nancy Mace, who have been very open about being in favor of releasing the Epstein files. But there is concern that one or both of them or others may flip. Now, Ghislaine Maxwell, this is from CBS News, plans to ask Trump to commute prison sentence, House Democrats say. There was a whole letter that was written. I will link to that letter in the episode description. It was signed by Jamie Raskin, a little bit of a lengthy letter that goes on about the treatment of Ghislaine Maxwell in prison, all of the complimentary favors that she is receiving, all of the help that she is receiving in prison, and the fact that it looks as if she is going to ask Trump to commute her prison sentence. This furthers the idea that she has some sort of information or dirt. The fact that she has not perished in the same way that Jeffrey Epstein did indicates that she may have some sort of dead man's switch, some way to basically say, if you remove me, the information about you will be released. And instead, you're going to treat me well, and eventually you are going to commute my prison sentence. That is what this all appears to be. I'm going to read from the CBS News article here. It says, quote, the letter says the information received demonstrates either that Ms. Maxwell is herself requesting you release her from her 20-year prison sentence for her role as a co-conspirator in Jeffrey Epstein's international child sex trafficking ring, or that this child sex predator now holds such tremendous sway in the second Trump administration that you and your DOJ will follow her clemency recommendations. The letter also alleges that Maxwell is receiving preferential and lenient treatment at the Bryan Federal Prison Camp in Texas, where she was transferred over the summer after meeting with Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche to discuss the Epstein case. Federal law enforcement staff working at the camp have been waiting on Ms. Maxwell hand and foot, says the letter signed by Representative Jamie Raskin, the ranking Democrat on the committee. In their letter, Democrats call for Blanche to be made available for a public hearing to answer questions from the committee about the use of law enforcement resources and any, quote, potential exchange of favors, end quote. It is absolutely perplexing to imagine the President of the United States pardoning Ghislaine Maxwell. That said, it would not be all that surprising, especially considering all of the other pardons that Donald Trump has recently enacted. For example, Trump issues pardons for Rudy Giuliani, Sidney Powell, and others involved in the 2020 fake elector scheme. Trump gave an unconditional pardon to these folks. These were members of his 2020 campaign legal team. They were originally arrested for their involvement in a scheme to alter the slates of electors chosen by states that voted against the Republican nominee in that year's presidential election. A statement announcing a list of 77 people who were pardoned was tweeted out late Sunday evening at 10:54 p.m. local time by Trump's clemency czar, Ed Martin. This is in an article by The Independent in the UK. And look, Rudy Giuliani admitted after all of this that there was no widespread fraud in the 2020 election. He confessed to it. And there was mention made of the fact that by pardoning these folks now and into the future, these people can repeat the same thing. And it shows that Donald Trump is not afraid to pardon anyone who does it in the future. Essentially, if Democrats are voted in, he will attempt again to use his loyalists to overturn the results of those elections. Now, how about this? This is from Medium.com by Chris Armitage. The bombshell inside Trump's $1.3 billion pardon market. They call him the pardon for pay president. I'm going to read through some of this because this is fascinating.
In December 2020, federal prosecutors unsealed evidence of a presidential pardon bribery scheme during Trump's first term. Court documents revealed a bribery conspiracy involving substantial political contribution in exchange for a presidential pardon. No charges were filed. 4 years later, Trump returned to office and issued clemency to more than 1,600 individuals in his first 10 months. For context, Obama issued 1,927 grants over 8 years. Biden issued fewer than 200 over 4 years. Trump's first term produced 237 over 4 years. So, stepping outside the article here for a second, he's done 1,600 in 10 months, almost as many as Obama did in 8 years, more than Biden did in his 4 years, and more than five times the amount that Trump did, more like six times the amount he did in his first term. His current pace, this is going back to the article, exceeds all modern presidents combined. Now, here's this. These pardons eliminated $1.3 billion in court-ordered restitution and fines owed to crime victims. Documented payments to Trump, his family businesses, and his allies preceded many of them. So what are we saying here? Essentially, Donald Trump received payments through his PACs, the political action committees, to his reelection campaigns, to whatever, right? He received this money from these folks who are on the hook. What did he do? He pardons them, offers them clemency, which also means they now don't have to pay the millions of dollars that they were going to have to pay. I guess in this case, $1.3 billion in total. Here's one example of that before we move on. Trevor Milton founded Nikola, an electric truck company. In October 2022, a jury convicted him of securities fraud after prosecutors proved he deceived investors with a viral video showing a prototype truck appearing to drive under its own power. The truck was actually rolling downhill after being towed to the top. The jury deliberated for hours after a two-month trial. Federal prosecutors sought $695.2 million in restitution from Milton, including $680 million to Nikola shareholders and $15.2 million to wire fraud victim Peter Hicks. Many investors lost retirement savings during the COVID-19 pandemic and waited for repayment. So essentially, this guy defrauded stockholders out of $700 million and one individual out of $15.2 million, which he wired in investment. It was all fraudulent, and so the court said you need to pay these people back. In October 2024, this was, of course, 1 month before the elections, Milton and his wife donated more than $1.8 million to Trump's reelection campaign. Milton personally contributed $920,000 to the Trump 47 Committee and $284,000 to the RNC, the Republican National Committee. The combined total represented one of the largest individual contributions to Trump that cycle. 5 months later, on March 27, 2025, Trump personally called Milton to inform him of his pardon. Trump granted it the next day. The pardon eliminated both Milton's four-year prison sentence and the $700 million restitution obligation. Investors will never be repaid. The return on investment, 37,400%. The fact that this corruption is so blatant and in our faces and that nothing is being done about it is an absolute travesty. Okay, the last one here on the corruption side of things, this is in an online newspaper called AboveTheLaw.com. It says, conservative warning to judges, get on board with Trump's agenda or get impeached. And it is just essentially a threat from Republicans saying to the judges, if you do not rule in favor of Donald Trump, in favor of the GOP talking points, we will impeach you. Now, in many ways, the actual ability to impeach, to remove, is not likely to happen as it would require many Democrats to go along with it. This is essentially a threat to them to get on board, to avoid being in the limelight, being the targets of Republicans. The article says, though conservatives won that case, talking about Trump versus Casa, it says, and they have a wildly partisan win rate at the Supreme Court, panelist Chad Mizell, former chief of staff to the attorney general, still finds plenty to complain about. His comments called out district courts that have tried to place constitutional speed bumps on the Trump agenda. Like his former boss, Mizell says these are liberal judges that aren't acting in good faith. And he knows what we should do about it, impeach them. And then I'm going to read the quote from Mizell here and then I'll move on. So it says, what's going to force the Supreme Court to do something is fundamentally political pressure. It's going to be when Congress starts impeaching judges and saying, you are now encroaching into our territory, Zell said during a panel discussion at the Federalist Society's annual lawyers meeting in Washington. Mizell's impeachment battle cry followed a somewhat cryptic story he shared that appeared to involve an implicit threat his father once issued to put down a stray cat in the family's yard. What do I think Donald J. Trump should do? He should stand up, and he's already done this, and say, judges, I know how to deal with stray cats. Now, speaking of judges, there is a prominent conservative judge whose name is Mark Wolf, who stepped down, he resigned, and he called Trump, quote, uniquely dangerous. This is from PBS NewsHour. I'm going to read his quote here. He was asked by Amna Nawaz, you have spent 50 years with the Department of Justice and on the bench. Which, by the way, stepping outside that quote for a second, 50 years. He was appointed by Reagan. This guy has been in conservative politics and in the judiciary for much longer than I have been alive. So she says, you have spent 50 years with the Department of Justice and on the bench. You have seen a lot of presidents come and go. What is so worrying about this moment and this president that made you want to speak out? His response, I think this president is unique and uniquely dangerous. When a president is elected, he or she is entitled to set priorities for the Department of Justice, but we have an ideal that's crucial to me and many others of equal justice under law. And this president repeatedly, overtly directs the Department of Justice to prosecute his perceived political enemies at the same time that the Department of Justice is not investigating possible corruption by people close to the president and people who are doing things to profit the president and his family. So that's utterly inconsistent with, as I said, this fundamental principle of equal justice under law, to which I have dedicated my professional life for 50 years, and it's personal to me. It's deeply disturbing. Another thing that Wolf said that I think is interesting, he said, what Nixon did episodically and covertly, knowing it was illegal or improper, Trump now does routinely and overtly. Nixon was impeached and resigned from office for one specific illegal act that we're aware of, right? A cover-up scheme. Donald Trump has dozens of these impeachable acts, if not hundreds. He's doing them out in the open, like Wolf said, routinely and overtly. It's in our face. But essentially, he says, and so far he's been right, there's nothing you can do about it. Okay, I'm going to highlight two last quick articles here. One is from thenewrepublic.com, and it says, confirmed, ICE is arresting American citizens and lying about it. This article goes into detail about at least 130 that we know of U.S. citizens that have been detained or arrested from ICE during these raids. Most of them, they're claiming, are assaulting police, but many of those are being thrown out. At least 50 so far have simply been thrown out because there's no evidence of that, or the evidence that is provided is contrary to that. ICE is arresting U.S. citizens for doing things like filming or protesting, being in the vicinity of, you know, their arrests that they are carrying out. It's an interesting article. I recommend taking a look at it as it really highlights the unconstitutionality of ICE and their actions currently. Lastly, in perhaps a bit of a bright spot, the Supreme Court heard arguments in the case regarding Trump's tariffs, and they will be making a determination on whether or not they are lawful. They have until June or so to do so. I don't know what the actual expected timeline is for them to come out with their ruling. But for the moment, it does appear that they may be headed towards not in favor. They may shoot down his tariffs, which from an inflationary standpoint, from a at least short-term economic standpoint, this would, of course, hopefully be a good thing and signal that the Supreme Court is willing to vote against Donald Trump in some ways. Now, the unfortunate part of that is that it's all about money, right? Will removing tariffs benefit the impoverished? Will it benefit the poor? Will it benefit the average everyday American citizen? Well, that's to be seen. The case very well may be that they are going to vote no on this because of the pressure from the wealthy. Billionaires who support Trump may not want to come out outright and say, these tariffs affect us. They are affecting the stock market where we have our money invested. They are hurting our corporations. They're hurting the bottom line. They don't want to come out and say that outright. And so the pressure is put on, in the back end on these Supreme Court justices. I read somewhere that it is very wealthy people's money that is funding the lawsuits that brought this about to the Supreme Court in the first place. So I'm wary to call it a huge win sustained economic growth in terms of collapse is not a good thing. But there is a chance that it relieves some pressure on inflation, and that could trickle down. I hate to use the word trickle down. But if inflation is having an effect on grocery prices and having an effect on housing and those types of things, the thought that in the short term it could relieve some of that pressure for people is a good thing. All right, I want to end the episode simply by saying that we're in kind of an odd time in regards to the momentum of the Trump administration. On the one hand, we're seeing this victory in these off-cycle elections with Mamdani and the governors all going blue. We're seeing Trump's approval ratings decrease. We're seeing more and more Republicans or independents that voted for him who are now upset because he's not keeping his promises. People are saying that they want him to be doing more for grocery prices and for the economy overall. He's not doing what he said he was going to do. We are seeing some pressure from the judiciary against Donald Trump's actions. We're seeing pressure when it comes to the Epstein files and Trump cracking under that. We're seeing that they're panicking about the midterms coming up next year. These things are all good, and it shows that maybe some momentum is being slowed down. On the other hand, we're seeing things like the Dems cave on the government shutdown. We're watching as Trump basically is taking all of this pressure put against him and continuing to say, I don't care, I'm going to do what I want. The Constitution, the law, the judiciary, Congress, what the people want, all of that be damned. It's the Donald Trump show, and I'm going to do what I want. In my conversation with, again, my friends, group chat, Johnny, Jake, Brian, we're talking about some of this shift in momentum and what it could mean and what's the best case scenario and what are our hopes. And one of them mentioned, you know, that their hope is that as pressure continues to build up on Donald Trump, and that hopefully they'll be busted in the midterms, that kills their momentum, that the judiciary will be able to clamp down a little bit tighter, prevent them at least from stealing elections, and that come the next election cycle, it will be an overwhelming blue wave. That's the hope. That's not necessarily their expectation. But I think the general consensus that we came up with from that chat is that Donald Trump is not necessarily the main threat here. The fact that he was voted into office, that there is a significant portion of the U.S. population that likes what he stands for. It's not about Donald Trump. It's about the minds of the American people that put him there. And that when he's gone, those people will continue to vote. They will continue to be angry. Their mindset will likely persist, and they will look for the next fascist or dictator or whoever's going to promise to fulfill these things that they want to see done. They will, you know, work to put them in power. And the Democrats are boring. I'm sorry, but they're boring. They're weak. No one's excited. What were people excited for? They were excited for Mamdani, right? They were excited for the idea of a change in the status quo, a move away, a shift away from neoliberalism towards a more left candidate. Will the Democratic establishment allow for something like that in 2028? Will we see Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez? Will we see someone like Bernie Sanders? It won't be Bernie. He's too old now. He knows that. You know, does the future of the Democrat Party move more left? And does that excite people more? Anyway, I don't know. And we have a long time. We have a few years now before we really find out. This is a time that's going to be written about in history books, should we have history books, a few decades from now. When it comes to zooming out into the macro collapse view of things, obviously the actions that are being taken by the U.S. administration is impacting that. And I'm actually doing an episode next week, I believe it's my Tuesday episode, that talks about the way that authoritarian regimes affect collapse overall. So that will be coming up next week. In the meantime, we just sit and watch. I'm struggling a bit with that myself. I have felt my mental health over the last week or so just decline, and I'm realizing that I'm stressing too much about things that I can't control. So I know for myself, I'm going to take, you know, this moment to realign my expectations, to make plans for myself, to do the things that I can control to put myself in the best position possible. I hope that you do too. I hope that you're not stressing too much about things that are outside of your power. If you are, if you find yourself filled with anxiety, pick one thing or two things that you can do to ground yourself, to take control over your own situation, and be at peace, essentially knowing that you're doing what you can. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next week. Hey, Corey here. If you are listening to the back catalog of Breaking Down Collapse, thank you. Those episodes are so vital. They're so important. But I also wanted to let you know that I am now doing daily episodes. Yes, that's right. Here on the podcast, daily episodes. So if you are enjoying the back catalog, great. Please also feel free to zoom forward to the most recent episodes. Catch us daily. They are quick little episodes, and I think you'll enjoy them. Thanks.